This is episode number 5 with forensics investigator Dmitry Korneev. Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple. Welcome everybody to episode number 5. Super excited that you are on board and that you're following these episodes. Today we've got a very special podcast. I've invited my friend Dmitry Korneev onto the show. It was such a hassle to get Dmitry on the show because he actually works at Deloitte US, and he's constantly traveling, always in the air, always all over the place. And it took me several goes to actually get this podcast running, but finally we got there, and I was super happy about that. So something you need to know about Dmitry is that this guy is like a just unstoppable engine. He's been working at Deloitte for 10 years now. 10 years in one of the top 4 consulting firms. And he's worked in many different countries. So I think he's actually lived in at least 3 countries, but for prolonged periods of time. But he's actually been to over 30. And in more, like some of them, he just travels for leisure. But a lot of them, he actually went for work. He's constantly flying around the place. He worked back in Deloitte Russia for some time. Then he worked in Deloitte Australia. And now he's working in Deloitte US, so in New York. And it is very interesting what he does. He is actually in the forensics department, and the forensics department for computer fraud analytics. So that's not just cyber fraud, but actually Dmitry deals a lot with investigations that are court-related or even criminal proceedings where data has to be extracted from computers, laptops, mobile phones. It has to be analyzed, and then results have to be presented in court. And it's very interesting because not only you need to extract the data, but also you have to go through it. You have to create algorithms. You have to find the insights that you're looking for that might help the court case or might help the investigator, might even help the police, and then present it to them. And also there's a lot to do with the accuracy. As you can imagine, you have to be very accurate. You cannot just miss evidence. So there's a lot of that involved, and that is what his job is. And he moved to New York just recently, maybe just a year ago or something like that. Before, he was one of the top rated forensics cyber investigators in Australia. And I remember working with him at Deloitte Brisbane. He would always be constantly called down to Melbourne or to Sydney to perform some data extraction and investigation there. So this is a very, very interesting person. And in this podcast, you will learn about fraud analytics. So it's a completely new area of analytics that you may have never heard of before, may have never even considered going into that path as a career, but it does exist. And it's very, very large because, as you can imagine, most of the communications now happen via SMS, via email, and extracting that data and analyzing it and presenting it in these court cases and other places, other investigations, is a very important skill. It is a very valued skill. So this career path does exist, and it does require data science skills. You will learn a lot about structured versus unstructured analytics. Dmitry talks about how 80% of his work is with unstructured data, and we talk a little bit about the tools and methods that he uses there. We also talk about a few methods for structured analytics. So for example, we'll discuss Benford's law, and you'll learn what Benford's law is and how that data science law, data science principle, can be applied to find fraud in massive volumes of spreadsheets and things like that. You will learn about the 5 steps that he takes when performing fraud analytics. Also, we had some great casual conversations about working and traveling and how he leverages the two, how he manages to survive at one of the top consulting firms where the hours are just insane. Sometimes at Deloitte, you are on projects where you don't have any other choice but to work from like 7 a.m. till 2 a.m. the next night. So sometimes the hours can be very draining, but we'll talk about how he managed to survive there for 10 years and how he actually loves what he does, how he enjoys it, and how he mixes it up, how he finds new ways to challenge himself and continuously grow in that organization. And we also talk about relaxing and taking a break, and Mitra and I share some of the examples how we do things that help us recharge our batteries and get back strained into it. And I think that's a very important aspect for any data scientist, whether you're already in a full throttle career or you're just learning and preparing for a career, because you cannot stop. As a data scientist, you have to keep pushing, you have to keep going, have to keep getting better and better and better all the time, have to keep up. And that's why knowing how to properly take a break, how to recharge your batteries, knowing yourself is very important. And so off we go. Please welcome Dmitry Korneyev from Deloitte. Dmitry, what's up? Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, man. How are we doing?
Good, good. It's been a long time, hey? I haven't seen you in ages.
Yeah, I think it's been almost 2 years since I moved to the States. Yeah, I probably should come and visit you in Australia. It's been quite some time.
You haven't been back in 2 years.
I came to Australia in October for 2 weeks, and I think we caught up at the time, but it was pretty brief visit.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I've been traveling around the world since. But I mean, you guys, you're so far from here. Like, you don't quite realize how far Australia is until you leave it. Like, when you live there, you don't think so, but you move to another part of the world and you think, okay, well, why would I go there?
I know.
So I'm currently in this state. I mean, it may change one day, but yeah, that's where I am.
Yeah, I was in the US as well just like a month ago, and everybody was like, where are you from? Like, Australia. Like, oh, that's so far away, so far away.
How do you like New York?
New York was really good. Like, I thought it was, I stayed in Harlem. It was a very nice area, so safe. Like, we could walk around in the evening, so I was very surprised. The only thing about downtown New York, the main part I didn't like, is like, it's very narrow, and I found that the city is quite dirty. Maybe it was just that it was the summer heat that made it feel that way. But to be honest, I like the suburbs more than the center. How about you?
Well, I was thinking exactly the same way when I moved here first, and I live in Hoboken, which is not in Manhattan. It's a kind of area where you can escape, and the streets are wider, and it's a bit more relaxed. But I think your reaction is a typical reaction. Well, one of the typical reactions of someone who moves here from Australia, because it's a different pace of life, and it's pretty built up, and you need time to adjust. And it took me probably about 3 to 4 months, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it right now, but I understand where you are, and I was thinking exactly the same way when I came here first time.
Totally, yeah. I can imagine. It's definitely a different way of life. And last time I remember, like, when we were talking quite a lot and meeting up on a daily basis, we were working together at Deloitte. And back then, I remember you were doing a lot of, in Australia, Deloitte Australia, Brisbane, and then you moved to Melbourne. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I moved to Melbourne for 1 year, and then I moved to the United States.
Yeah, and like last time when we were working together, well, last like ages ago when we were working together, I remember, so you're a fraud investigator, you do a lot of forensics work, and you were doing a lot of actually getting into, I might even say, hacking into software and hardware to get the data out to supply it to more junior data scientists for analysis. So can you tell me if that has changed and like what are you up to now?
No, it hasn't changed that much. I guess my role is slightly different than mine because I'm no longer directly touching the systems and pulling data from there, but now I'm more focused on processing and hosting and analysis of this data for actual fraud analysis or hosting for fraud investigators. So it's probably not a part of the cycle. I mean, I still do what I was doing in Australia. Just the focus might be a little different, and I'm looking at the same area, like fraud investigations, forensic, but slightly from a different angle. And it's a different perspective, and actually I'm quite enjoying it. Having a chance to see it from a different angle, because probably I wouldn't have had this chance in Australia just because of the maturity of the market and the demands of the clients, like what they wanted us to do over there was a bit different. So yeah, I'm still in the same space, but my role is, I mean, I'm in the same firm, but my role is slightly different. But I'm quite happy that I'm actually doing something different here, because probably like you, I mean, I like being everywhere and trying out different things, and some things may work out, some may not. But if they don't work out, you just move on. If you like them, you just do them until you stop enjoying doing them, and then you move on to someone else.
Yeah, totally. And I remember you being like that, exactly like you described. But what really surprises me and impresses me to a huge extent is how you manage to keep all this diversity of interest within one company. You've been with Deloitte for how long now?
Well, it's more than 9 years. Two things needs to be taken into account. First, I worked in 5 different countries by now. And technically, it's one company. But if you move to another country, you still retain certain experience and spirit, but the operational models might be different. And what and the markets are different. So what you do in my country may not be relevant to another, and so on. So all my 5 spells have been quite different. And it allowed me to try different things. Plus, you probably know from your experience, the structure of the firm is not very rigid because it's a professional services firm, and moving between the service lines, it's pretty easy, and you can work on projects which are not typically handled by your department. So it's pretty flexible. So yeah, I mean, I've been in one firm, but at no point I would say I was bored and I was feeling like, okay, I'm doing the same thing for years and years and I need to try something else. I mean, if I get to the point when it becomes repetitive, then I mean, I may move to another company, but so far it's been very diverse, and I've been thoroughly enjoying it.
I can imagine, probably very challenging as well.
Sometimes it can be. I mean, you would know that when you work in professional services firm, sometimes you're held busy, sometimes it might be a bit slower. Because it's project based. So yeah, there have been periods when it was really tough and you had to manage multiple engagements, pretty complex ones. Yeah, it's a job which requires to be on the top of everything. And yeah, I mean, it may be chaotic sometimes, but I like it. I mean, I like when it might be unpredictable, and when you can get called anytime, and like you sit nothing doing and then things just blow up. Well, everyone is different, but I've been enjoying it. So
yeah, totally. And I remember back in Brisbane when you were like the only, when this part of the service line was only maturing, and you were the first and only person who was able to perform that level of hacking and getting into accounts for fraud investigation purposes. I remember that went on for like a year or two, and you were being pulled apart or torn apart by everybody. Every department wanted you. You even had to fly down to Melbourne and Sydney and do work for them there just because you were the only person in Australia who was capable of such a thing. And do you think the industry, the analytics fraud industry, has moved on since then? How do you think it's developing at this stage?
Yeah, well, it's definitely evolving. And well, back in Brisbane, like the firm I was working on was a kind of a startup. I mean, the service line. So in a small startup company, you get exposure to different things, and you do this and that, which might be different when you work for a large organization or a large service line. The thing about fraud analytics, the purpose, the ultimate objective is probably still the same, because the way people commit fraud, it's changing in their high-tech world, but within the financial industry, it might be still the same. But because of the variety of the systems we have to deal with, in terms of when you have to pull out the evidence and actually find something to prove allegations, this area is getting more and more challenging. And because right now, you know, everything is moving to the cloud, and for forensic, it represents a big challenge because, well, typically it's hard to get access there. So you kind of have to hack it legitimately. You always find a way around, but the more the complexity of the system represents a huge challenge. And I think this another part of the story is that the tools that you have at your disposal, they usually cannot do what you want to achieve just because of the landscape, the technology landscape is changing so quickly, so that the vendors, they cannot catch up typically. So they give you a product which, well, is expected to give you a certain capability to pull out something. But then you find that it needs to be customized, and it has to be done usually under time pressure and a typical investigation. It may take like a few weeks, and it's not like like a SAP implementation when you can do it for years and massage it to perfection. It's really you get under pressure. You have a very short time frame, and then you find out that the tools that you have, they just cannot do what you want to do. And you kind of have to work out solutions on the fly. And yeah, I've been seeing it for years, and I still it still remains a trend. So it's part of the, I guess the one of the features of this industry, that typical project management skills which you would deploy in software implementation or something like that, they not really applicable. And you really have to, if you're a project manager, you have to develop your own skill set. And it comes down to data analytics as well, because it's the thing about my world, because it's a mix of unstructured and structured data analytics. And it's more about unstructured analytics. Unless you investigate like financial transactions or accounting irregularities, in most cases you have to look, it's more about textual analytics. And sometimes it's both. And you kind of can have to consider both parts. And another thing that you really have to, when it comes down to finding evidence, you don't really have to chase every hole. So you have to be a bit intuitive and know where to look at and kind of touch different things and piece them together. So it's a specific mindset plus specific skill set.
Yeah, definitely. I remember that the time when we were dealing with textual data, and actually not just, we were dealing with emails, but also with text messages. So you extract text messages from somebody's phone, and of course, legitimately, that has been confiscated through a police findings or something like that, and then you have to go through that. So there's a lot of unstructured data. I definitely remember that, and like I remember a couple of tools that we were using, especially this one when they sent it to us. I think it was from the UK. Do you remember that? Like this box came in, and inside this box was a briefcase, and you open it up and it's like got all these little gadgets to extract data from mobile phones. It looked like a James Bond type of thing. That was really cool. And so what kind of tools do you use? And I mean more like on the data side of things. What kind of software tools or programming languages do you use for your day-to-day job?
Yeah, so you refer to the specific hardware and software tools that we use for data extraction for forensic purposes. Mm-hmm. And it's slightly different to just typical data copying, because you have to, basically, you can't bring something to a court unless you can prove that you've copied everything, it's an exact copy. So the tools, the hardware and software tools, they have certain algorithm which calculates hash value or something which is a signature, and then which you can show to the court and say, okay, that's exact copy of the data. So in terms of data analysis, I mean, there are some very specific forensic analysis products like InCase from Guidance Software or FTK from Access Data, which are all virtually focused on finding forensic artifacts in the data. In cases when you have a large scale review, like if it's an investigation, it might be, you may need just one person to really drill into the data and pull out some piece of evidence, but sometimes you have like 40 or 50 or 100 people which need to look on the data from a different perspective, because they may bring some special knowledge like accountants, lawyers, or subject matter experts, industry experts. So when you need to have all these people looking at the data, then you have to first do forensic processing, and it would typically involve extraction of metadata and just then hosting of the data in special platform. So for processing, the two biggest vendors are iPro and Nuix. And when it comes down to large scale hosting, the industry standard, it's called Relativity. So the company is called Kura, and it's pretty much a large scale hosting platform, having some analytics features, mostly surrounding predictive coding and textual analytics. So there is also another system called Recommind. It's getting pretty big here in the States, and it's probably the first country where it's going to hit the market. And yeah, it probably become global as well. So what I've just Lisa, they are all very well, that specific forensic discovery industry products. If we talk about more general analytical tools, I mean, we do a lot of, we do sometimes, we do a lot of database analytics. So we use pretty much the same thing like SQL, non-SQL databases. Sometimes we need to program skills as well. And there are people in my team who are pretty good with Python or C Sharp or other programming languages. Yeah, but we need them on an ad hoc basis. So, yeah, that's probably the tools that we use on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, that's really cool, because all of those tools that you just listed, the forensic discovery analytics tools, they're completely new to me, and I'm sure to most of our listeners, they'll be absolutely alien. But it's a very good thing to at least know about them and know how they operate if you want to get into that space. So we'll definitely include them in the show notes. I'll flick you an email later so that you can maybe supply me this list. But like, just out of interest, and so that we get to know how this whole forensics type of project operates, can you tell us about the life cycle of a forensics project? What is discovery? What comes after discovery? Maybe there's something that comes before. What are the steps involved?
There is a term called EDRM, which is called e-discovery something something. I probably should know what it means. But basically, it's a five stage process, and it used to be three only, but now it has expanded since, just because of the way industry is growing. So typically, it starts with information governance. And it's an information government from a discovery perspective. What it means that a company which operates in a highly regulated industry, and at the moment it's mostly financial institutions and pharmaceutical companies. So a company like that might be required to respond to litigation requests very quickly, especially here in the States. Like if you get sued and you are requested to provide emails for 50 people, you may be required to do it within 2 weeks, otherwise you'll be in trouble. To do this, you may need to have special systems implemented within your IT environment. They're called legal hold systems. And so it probably wasn't the case 20 years ago, but right now it's becoming extremely important. So information governance is basically, it all comes down to your ability to manage your unstructured data and being able to provide the data at a short notice. So that's the big step. It's not something that you do as a part of an investigation, but that's what you may want to be doing on a continuous basis, just to be prepared. So that's the first. The second step, which is a step of a typical forensic or discovery method, it's what's called collection. And this is all about extraction of data from your system in a forensically sound manner. And at this point, you start using the hardware and software tools which you saw in Brisbane when you were there. So the next step is processing. And it's, when we talk about data processing in the discovery sense, it's first of all about being able to pull out metadata from all types of data you may come across. So because in e-discovery world, we don't really, when we collect the data, we just pick up everything. So it's not, we may get databases, emails, like all sort of homogeneous, data which is completely different. And in this case, you need to be able to process all of them and pull out metadata from all of them, because that's, for any forensic matter, it comes down to first looking at the document and second looking at the metadata, and they kind of complement each other. So when you do processing, yeah, it's all the systems that do discovery processing, they need to have this capability.
Yeah. So sorry, data. Just interrupt you there. Metadata, you mean like, for instance, out of a photo, you can get where it was taken or the timestamp when it was taken, things like that.
Yes, things like that. Everything which is basically the properties of the document. But you have to, the important thing to understand, it's more than you can see if you just right click on the file in Windows. Because there are different layers of metadata. There's a metadata sitting within the file itself. There is a metadata which sits within the container, which where file may reside, or you can have a metadata which resides at the file level in a computer system, which you don't even see, but it's still there. So in certain cases, it's important just to find all these pieces and bring them together, because they kind of provide the entire picture. and they may give you an idea of what has happened. So this part is a process. The next step is called review or hosting. And at this point, this is where you take all the data and the metadata, put it in a hosting platform, and you get like 50, 100, or how many, whatever number of people you have to review it. And usually, typically, they would be subject matter experts. And I guess the specifics of the discovery review is that it's a legal world, so you may have some privileged information. For example, it might be information which one person is supposed to see and another person is not supposed to see. So you have to make sure that they can only see what they're supposed to look at. And if they are not, there are things like redactions where you basically can remove certain portion of information from your file and give it to another party for review. So at this point, it's not really analytical. You can have analytics at this point as well, but it becomes a massive project management exercise. And the last piece of the cycle is production. When reviewers look at the data, they find a set of relevant documents, and it's called responsive in the discovery world. So from this set, it has to go to another party so that they can review it in their system. And there is a whole science behind how you do it to make sure that first they can read this data and they get only what they're supposed to get. So yeah, that's probably a brief summary of what a typical matter would involve.
Okay, that's very interesting. So where would the data science algorithms, if they need to be applied, in which step would they come in?
They would come in between processing and review, because one of the key components of the review is data culling, and there are many ways you can do it. And traditional approaches based on keywords are they in the past. Right now, especially if it's a large corporation, it's the cost is the most important factor, because for many companies it's a compliance issue, and if it's compliant, basically they want to do it cheap. And so there are, you mentioned textual algorithms. So there are different techniques which can help you isolate all non-responsive documents straight away before you start the review. And so you basically remove all these documents. And then there are certain techniques which can help you tell which data is not responsive, even if you don't look at it. Basically, you pick a sample, you find the documents which are relevant, non-relevant, then you throw it back in the entire population, and then the system use the algorithm to propagate those code and tell which other documents might be relevant or not. In this world, you have to be extremely careful using those techniques, because the cost is one side, but in the legal world, there is a requirement to review everything and not to miss a single bit. So there is no room for error. That's why it's those algorithms, they exist, but not every company would use them. It really depends on the case. So sometimes you just need to make sure, you need to get 100% result. You have to make sure that everything has been reviewed. And if you don't get there, you just won't use these techniques. But there are many cases when it's a little bit relaxed, and you can use advanced algorithm and just get to the point quickly. And well, assuming, okay, there is a, there could be an error, but we're fine with that.
Okay. So it sounds like an extreme case of a machine learning exercise where you're doing some classification and of documents, and there's absolutely no room for error, because normally you would expect some sort of level of error from a machine learning algorithm. But I guess as the legal requirements and the increase, and as it's a more serious case, the less of an error you can afford to make, and therefore you some techniques you just cannot use anymore.
Yeah, it I think it's a good summary. Well, it's not always the case there is no room for error. Sometimes you can have a small error if it comes down to, because what's happening this right now, typically all the tools that and systems that I just told you about, they were designed to serve the needs of the industry, which is a legal review. But what many people have seen since that you can take those systems outside of the e-discovery world and use them to solve other business problems, where you have a mix of structured and unstructured data. And when you put them in this world, then you have a room for error, because it may be your purpose may be more strategic than operational. And it might be the case that you don't have to chase every hole. And I guess when we move to that part of the industry, it's not a discovery industry, but it's something else, then you have more flexibility and power to use advanced categorization algorithm to make the review more efficient.
Okay, like tell me if this is a correct example. For instance, like a huge mining company with like several millions of dollars of monthly turnover, they want to investigate any duplicate payments of invoices. And so instead of looking through every invoice, which would cost them a lot of money, they launch an algorithm which picks out these duplicate invoices, and maybe it'll find only 80% of the invoices, but it'll be a cheap algorithm. It might cost like several thousand dollars to implement, but it'll save them a couple of million dollars in the month. Is that a good example?
Yes, it's a good example. You pick an example from a traditional transactional forensic analytics space. It's definitely what we do quite a lot, but it's probably, I mean, you may not need really a blend of structured and structured analytics to solve this problem. In certain cases you may, but sometimes you can just do it at the database level. I guess another example could be contract review, and that's what we do a lot of for financial institutions, because they may have a lot of contracts which are not stored in electronic form, and then when you need to have an ability to scan them, to do character recognition, and then to be able to index this data and do searches, and sometimes you need to match what's in the contract against the financial transactional data.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why both things become important, because you cannot do one without the second one.
Okay.
So it's probably just an expansion to the example that you gave me. So yeah, you look at the financial transactions, but you also look at some sort of contractual background.
Okay. And you personally, which kind of data do you work with mostly? Is it structured or is it unstructured?
It's both. It's probably more unstructured. But I guess it depends on the objective of the business case.
Okay, I see.
I mean, yeah, there is a business case, you have to solve it, and you pick up the data that you need to do it. Well, I would say most of my cases, they require unstructured data, but it's different case by case.
So would you say that unstructured data is becoming kind of the predominant medium? Like, because structured data, there are algorithms and it's kind of easier to deal with. So would you say that for somebody who wants to maybe get into this space, it's a good idea to start considering and learning how to work with unstructured data early on?
So the stats that I've heard, that a typical company would have 80% of unstructured data and 20% of structured. It may be different company by company, but that's the numbers that I've heard. And it would probably be fair to say, I don't know if you would agree, that, well, we've been doing analytics on the structured data for years and years, and it's a pretty developed space. And with the structured data, it's still developing, let's put it this way. So the forensic tools, in the forensic world, it's been the other way around, always. But the thing is, the objectives of the forensic discovery method, they're usually quite narrow. So that's why we have the tools, but we typically use them to solve a particular problem. So yeah, I would probably agree it's a growing area, and it's not been developed. And one of the ways to actually make it more mature is to take the discovery tools that we have and expand them. And it could be used as a beachhead to get there. Have you heard of, I mean, what have you heard about the unstructured analytics? Where is it? From a broader perspective, because I'm probably looking at from my perspective, which might be a bit narrow.
With machine learning developments and with the increasing processing power software, natural language processing, for example, which is even like another form of unstructured data when you have like audio recordings of phone calls, right? That's developing very rapidly. And even like you take your iPhone and you want to dictate a message, it's very spot on. And you'll notice that if you try to dictate a voice message on your iPhone, it won't work if you're not connected to the internet, and that's because it's using algorithms online to process what you're speaking into it. And same thing about with textual data. So it's like processing scanned images is a bit, of course, more complex, but you can use machine learning algorithms such as decision trees and random forest or other gradient boosting algorithms to get that very, very spot on and help identify exactly what's going on, or even some naive Bayes machine learning algorithms will do that trick. But then once the characters are recognized, identifying semantics and what's actually being said in the message, that's the fun part, I find, that trying to identify exactly what emotion is being conveyed and extract that from the textual information.
Yeah, this thing has been for quite some time. I think is it called how is it called when you look at the like social media communication and try to figure out the mood of the audience?
Sentiment.
Sentiment analysis, yeah. Yeah, it's probably more applicable to web analytics as well. That's what you deal with a lot of textual.
Like scraping Twitter and stuff
Yeah,
like
I wouldn't say that actually has any impact on what we do.
that.
You typically analyze company information. You can just, yeah, you don't go online and.
Yeah, but this is still the same algorithms or same kind of approaches and methodologies can be applied once you have that textual information, regardless where it came from, Twitter or from a document inside a company.
Yeah, absolutely.
The
No, the
learnings.
algorithms are the same. It's just the data sources are different.
Yeah, and so that's some great examples of some unstructured data that you deal with, and probably like the main goal. I was just thinking of some outcomes that you'd be looking for, but probably the main goal is to find that sentiment inside messages or look for specific, like you said, keywords are going away; they're not as relevant anymore. But at the same time, sometimes you might be looking for some keywords, so searching for that type of information and synonyms or misspellings of keywords, that could be helpful. Let's have a look at some examples of techniques for structured data. Just out of curiosity, are there any specific techniques that come to mind when you're dealing with structured data in a organization, and how those techniques can help identify fraud or just guide the investigation in certain directions?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say that complex from a data analytics perspective, because it comes down to the understanding of your understanding of the business case. And on a typical investigation, yeah, because you wouldn't do much of modeling or like a full-blown analysis. Your objective is to find a specific record or a specific piece of evidence. And yeah, and to get there, you need to understand the business case, and you need to define the rules, understand the rules of how to find something to prove an allegation, or well, based on what you have in the database. So yeah, I would say it's more about understanding the business logic and translation into database logic or wherever your information is coming from.
One example that pops into my mind is Benford's Law. Like I remember using that at Deloitte quite a lot. Were you involved in the Benford's Law investigations back at Deloitte?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting observation. It's well, from my experience, it's interesting from a scientific perspective, but in the real practical world, it doesn't help that much.
Really? I would think it's such a crazy and non-intuitive, but at the same time logical thing. I thought that it would come up quite a lot in investigations.
Well, it does. It just because typically if. Let's put it this way. If you have an objective to kind of give a complex review of how much risk a particular organization may carry in terms of a certain type of fraud, then that might be pretty good to present something like that. But if what you need to do is to find one transaction made a particular person, and in many cases it comes down to like that, this chart it's helpful, but it doesn't really. It may not point you exactly to where it is, and also Sometimes there are false positives, and there could be a number of explanations why we have this all anomalies. Yeah, it's an interesting technique. Well, it just probably more. Yeah, it doesn't. It may not help as often in the investigation world as you may think it does.
All right. Well, thanks for that. That's pretty insightful. Didn't know that about Benford's law, that it's not as it has quite a lot of false positives. But just for the benefit of our listeners, I'll quickly explain that it's just a good example of a technique that can be applied, like a data science technique that can be applied in for investigations. So basically, in very layman terms, what Benford law says is that if you take like an accounting spreadsheet and you just take all the numbers from that accounting spreadsheet, and then you look and put them all into one bucket, and then you pick them out and look at the distribution of the very first number or the very first digit in each numbers, in all the numbers. So you'll see that number one, the digit one, comes up the most frequently. Digit two comes up second most frequently. Like digit one comes up, correct me if I'm wrong, Dmitry, but it comes up like 36% of the time. Then digit two comes up like 15% of the time. Digit three comes up less. So it's like a, looks like a log normal type of distribution. I don't really remember which exactly distribution it is. And so if you're analyzing a company in terms of fraud, then you just take a spreadsheet or something that you're analyzing and you apply Benford's law. And if it doesn't apply, so if you can see that the distribution is different, that means there might be something dodgy going on. Is that a good summary of Benford's law?
No, it's a good summary. He came up with this law based on real-time, real-life observations. I can think only a few cases when it really helped to find.
Okay, yeah. But it's still, it's a good example, even though it might be like old and might be not as applicable anymore, or just there might be better algorithms. It's just a good example that there are some data science techniques and that's more like on the distribution side of things or data processing side of things that we normally don't encounter in our day-to-day work in insights type of data analytics. But at the same time, they're very powerful and they're used a lot in a different space in your world. So it's good to have this like little window to see what's going on in the world of forensics analytics.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a good thing to have, and it's a tool. It just doesn't work in isolation. It's something that you look at and may give you a direction, but you need to use other things to get to the bottom of the issue.
Awesome. Okay. And next thing I would like to do is, can we get a bit into your background? So obviously now you've told us about how you, the stuff you do at Deloitte, and it's we just mentioned, it's a completely new world for most of our listeners, it will be something new to discover. Can you tell us about your background? Like, what did you study and how did your background help you become successful in what you do now?
I have a degree in computer science and economics. Well, I have a double major, and I started doing IT audit and internal audit within Deloitte, but well, I got bored pretty quickly. I just didn't think it was good fun. And then, yeah, I had a chance to join the forensic team, and at the time, the firm was doing a large global investigation, and I joined, and I like it, and I've been with it since. I mean, the forensic is pretty broad term, and at the firm where I'm working, it's a mix of financial and IT analytics. When people ask me, what do you do, and I say forensic, they can think whatever, like autopsy or looking at the fingerprints. And if you Google forensic, you will see like there are like 50 or 60 branches of that science. So it's a pretty broad category. So, I mean, definitely my education helped me a lot. Also, to be successful and to enjoy it, you have to it's important to pay attention to details, but at the same time, you have to be very flexible, and it's a kind of a mix. So on one hand, you need to combine those skills to be able to find, to be able to look at small things, but at the same time, in many cases, you don't chase every hole, and you have to use your intuition to kind of find what you have to find. So yeah, I would say I like the occupation. It's an interesting area to be in, and you probably need to be a certain type of personality to enjoy it. But yeah, for some people, I think it's something that they may want to be doing, and they would enjoy all their life.
What kind of personality would you say you need to be?
You need to be able to like cows.
Cows?
Cows, yeah. And you, Well, to a certain extent. I mean, it's fine to be methodical, but in many cases, a typical case may twist many times. And as I said, typical project management techniques wouldn't work. So you have to be prepared that you go to the work, you come to the office in the morning and everything changes in one day and it's very difficult to predict. So you have to be prepared and sort of don't get despair and be able to adjust and adopt. Yeah, I think it's very, very important for that type of job. Once again, well, attention to details, it's what every data analyst would need. But probably in this world, it's extremely important because a very small thing may actually mean everything, as opposed to other areas of analytics or something else where you more look at the trends and kind of try to detach yourself from small things and see a bigger picture. You need to be able to see a bigger picture in the forensic world as well. But in many cases, sometimes you really have to kind of pick up on small things and really focus on it and kind of detach yourself from strategic trends, things like that. So yeah, being able to go from high level to low level and back, that's also quite important.
Sounds like there's quite a few challenges involved in this type of work.
Yeah, you can call it challenges. It's something which this type of work involves, and I personally enjoy it. I think many people would enjoy it. And again, it's an always evolving area, like many others. So you have to stay current with the trends and tools. Just a special occupation.
Yeah, that's cool. And what would you say is like I got from two perspectives, from like the extremes, what would you say is your or has been ever your biggest challenge in your 10 years with Deloitte in forensic? What has been your biggest challenge ever, and what has been your biggest success that you think?
Well, I mean, are you referring to a specific project or more like long term and short term challenges that I had to overcome?
Probably the long term and short term challenges.
It was a big challenge for me to develop that kind of mentality when, because I mean, I probably used to be really, really strategic in everything I was doing. And I like looking at the trends and predictions and kind of high level pictures. And it was difficult for me to kind of adjust myself and sometimes say, okay, stop for a second and just focus on this particular small thing and just investigate this issue and put everything else aside. It took me a few years to develop that kind of mentality, because especially when you're under pressure, sometimes it was just, I was asking, why are we spending so much time on this small thing? I mean, let's look at the high level picture. But at the end of the day, it was very important. That was a big challenge for me, and I spent some time to overcome it. In terms of my success, I mean, I like the international aspect of work. It's probably like in every area of analytics, but it's a very universal skill set, and you can apply it to in any geography. And I've been traveling around the world and for work, and not only. And I've been quite enjoying it. And I think in this area, it's same around the world, but the fraud by nature, it's different in each country. And like in developing, what you investigate in developing country is different to what you investigate in a very mature country. And it's not like one is more interesting or not. It just people commit fraud different ways, and sometimes the technology, the platforms, they just allow, do not allow to do certain things. It's interesting the way that it's a universal skill set. You can bring it to another geography, but you see that you have to. It's not like a programming language. Yeah, Python is Python everywhere. What you want to code, your task may be different, but it doesn't really matter where you are, and that's why you can be anywhere and do. Like you can be in India, you can live in a villa there, and you work for someone in the US. You can outsource everything. In this world, you can outsource small tasks, but in order to really do something to achieve, you really have to be present to understand the nature of the fraud, the cultural aspect, the entire picture. And I found it interesting. Yeah, as I said, I've lived in five countries. I mean, the technical skill set is very similar. But the fraud nature has been different. And again, being able to adjust and just being able to tell us, okay, you take all your experience, but you can use it the same way. That was interesting as well. And I'm still enjoying it. Am I making sense or?
Yeah, no, that's totally awesome, and I can see how that would be a bit different to data science, like the core data science, where, like you say, the skill is transferable 100% and can be applied or even outsourced to different geographies. Whereas here, whenever you move borders, even just the legal system itself is different, right? And the way people think is different. What is available, what is not available in terms of hardware and software is also different. And it must be an interesting challenge to always be like learning new stuff and just exploring different ways that you can do that same job or achieve the same tasks. And you mentioned you travel quite a bit. How many countries have you been to in total? And do you generally just enjoy traveling for leisure as well?
Yeah, I do both. I probably haven't been to as many as you might think, because I'm not kind of a person to go somewhere for 2 weeks and come back. I'd rather go to one country for an extended period than just literally go to all small corners. And that's what I'm right now doing in the United States. Well, I lived in five. I've probably been to between 20 to 30. But I mean, that's the way I like travel, and it's not about coming somewhere for 2 weeks, just going surfing, ticking the box, and go away. So I think I have a few other countries on my list, and I'm hoping to do the same thing with them.
Okay, and would you say it's important in a stressful line of work like yours? Because like I was in consulting, I was in Deloitte, but I only lasted for 2 years, and after that, it's not like not that I couldn't continue going, but you just realize how much pressure you are under constantly, like constantly going home at par, like past 8 p.m., 10 p.m., like having 120-hour weeks or like 110, 112, my record was hour weeks or something like that. It's pretty insane. The question is like, is it important for? Do you think it's important to take some time to relax, to like when you travel, to look around the place, the country, and find ways to just release that stress and have a normal life, have a social life, or have a have your own personal life, and then get back to work. Do you say that you have quite a bit of focus on that?
Yeah, I mean, work-life balance, it might be an issue if you're working consulting, and so it's a question for everyone, and all of us have different opinions on how much work you can do and what it should be. We all have different ways to recover and escape. I mean, I don't know how you do it, but some of us need more time. Some of us, they just need 15 minutes to do everything and they can go back to work. I would say I'm a visual person. So, I mean, some people listen to the music and it makes them calm and relaxed. It doesn't work with me, but if I see something, and it typically would be a piece of nature or in some kind of city landscape, if I see something that I like, I will recover extremely quickly. I would say in Australia, I love the beach. Here in New York, I like the New York City skyline. And yeah, it may take me literally 5 minutes of looking at it, and I'm good. I'm good to go back to work. So yeah, I travel a lot, and working in consulting requires a lot of traveling. I mean, it depends on your role, but I don't know. I think you travel a lot, and I do it every week. Well, a bit less now, but I used to travel a tremendous amount of time. That it doesn't really. I mean, I like traveling, so it suits me really well. And when I'm stressed, yeah, I find something to look at, and it's usually something which just catches my eye. It can be whatever. It just a place, usually a spot with which I establish an emotional connection. And I typically know what can be that sort of a place, but sometimes I just bump into it and I say, okay, that's it, and I get some energy from it, and yeah, I'm fully energized and go back to work.
That's very deep. I like that. That's a very deep,
Well,
profound
I
thought.
mean, I heard the theory that some of us are visual people like me. Some people, they really need to listen to something, and it can be sound of nature or music, and they just put on headphones, they listen for 5 minutes, and they are fine. Some people may need to talk to someone. I found my way of recovery, and it works for me. And then actually, I like that I found it, because it worked for me really, really well.
Yeah, that's really good, and I think I'm even going to benefit even from just this part of the conversation myself a lot, because recently I found that I take on a lot of stuff, like building courses and, you know, doing this podcast and like answering questions or managing projects and stuff like that. So I found that I take a lot on, and I find myself working constantly. Like, this is probably my third or second week, or I'm into my second week working 12 hours every day. And like, I forget about that I need to take time and, you know, go do something. For me, it's probably riding my motorbike, or like you say, like going for a walk in nature, things like that. So it's a good thing. Like, taking you as an example, a person who's managed to survive for 10 years in consulting and you still love it so much, it's a good testament to the fact that we need to take care of ourselves, and not just our just what we eat, but also how much time we give ourselves to rest. And it shouldn't be just rest 5 hours a day or something. It should be quality rest, like you say. Like, find something that helps you relax and helps you get your mind back and get the energy back to keep moving forward after that. So it's very, very profound. Thank you for sharing that.
No problem. So how do you usually recover? I mean, you mentioned motorbikes and...
Yeah, probably a motorbike for me. Okay. Yeah, so if like for me, it's kind of once a week thing. If I know I can, I'm doing a six day week, and then on Sunday I can get on the morning like 6 a.m. I can get on my motorbike and go for a ride to the racetrack, or just with some friends through the mountains. Yeah, after that I'm totally tired after that when I come back. Like, I can't do anything that day. I have so much adrenaline, and it's like a reboot to the system, you know. Mm-hmm. And then on Monday morning you wake up and you're like fresh again, ready to go for the week. So I guess it's different to your method, but everybody has their own. And hopefully our listeners who are listening to this will, you know, take a minute to pause, think about it, and, you know, find out for themselves what helps you recover the most. Is it something short? Is it something long? Is it something specific? Is it talking to someone? I think about things like, are you an introvert? Are you an extrovert? Just think of that one thing that helps you recover and get back to, whether it's doing data science or learning data science or pushing the boundaries of research further. Because whatever you're doing in this world is definitely important. And we need people like you to be energized to keep doing what you're doing. And just moving on to the closing part of our podcast today, from your perspective, where do you think, Dmitry, is the field of data science, or specifically fraud investigations, going in the next 5 to 10 years? So people who want to establish a career, who might want to get into a career in this space, what should they look out for? What should they prepare themselves for?
Yeah, well, I think they should realize that, well, it's probably a general comment that the amount of data is growing exponentially, and we will be relying on data analysis methods more and more going forward. Well, I would say in the forensic and discovery world, and I mentioned before, the challenge is going to be to use analytic methods in their unstructured data world and use it efficiently and taking into account the objectives of why we do it, and yeah, just being able to use them in together with the traditional structured analytics methods. So we, in the discovery world, there's a lot of going on surrounding predictive coding, text categorization. It's picking up quite a lot, especially for large scale reviewers, and big corporations are paying more and more attention to this. So if you want, I would say that if you really want to get in this world and establish yourself, you really have to look into the unstructured data analytic methods.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you for that. And any career aspirations that push you to become better and more proficient at what you do?
In terms of, well, I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and I think I'll keep doing it in the foreseeable future. I definitely want to develop more of a industry experience to be able to use those all these methods, investigation methods, efficiently, and to be able to conduct investigation. Well, understanding of the business is crucial, and it's crucial for traditional analytics as well. But I guess in my world, you really well understand all the business process, how it all works, and being able to apply your techniques, knowing how it works inside, it's very important. So I think maybe over the next 3-4 years, I'll keep developing my technical skills, but I'll probably focus on one particular industry and just develop
some domain knowledge. Yeah.
Yeah, some sort of domain knowledge.
Yeah, and that's definitely an important part. We speak about this in some of my courses, that domain knowledge is a very important part of the work of a data scientist, because it's a completely different story when you know what you're doing analytics about and on, versus when you don't know. And their domain knowledge can give you a massive advantage. So thanks for that. That's some very solid advice. And if our listeners would want to follow your career, or even maybe contact you in a way, is there any, what's the best way to get in touch, or just follow along and see how your career develops in the future?
Yeah, well, probably maybe my LinkedIn account would be the best spot to start. I probably should start a blog or something like that, but I have to confess I haven't been doing so far. So if it changes, I'll let you know. But for now, I think probably my LinkedIn profile would be
Yep,
the spot.
wonderful. We'll include the link to Dmitry's LinkedIn, so make sure to hit Dmitry up on LinkedIn and connect, so you can see how his career goes. And if Dmitry starts a blog or other social media, we'll definitely update the show notes in the future. And one final question for you today, what is the one book that you think will help our listeners become better data scientists?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. Well, you might be surprised, but I would say that the book I would recommend reading, it's called How Life Imitates Chess by Garry Kasparov.
Wow.
And it's not exactly about data science, but I would say more about data strategy. So chess, well, I used to be a chess player. I don't know if you ever played,
Yep,
but I used to
yep.
be this one. And it's not data analytics, but typically, it's considered one of the areas where the most intelligent man go, and he was the most intelligent one. And I'm still amazed that a human being can compete with a machine in that space. So he's not a data scientist, but he's a kind of data strategist. And you may know that he's an M he works at MBA schools in the States, and he delivers lectures on strategy quite a lot. So this book is pretty much what he's trying to do. This book is to take the world of chess and try to bring it to the business world. And he's not the first guy from non-business environment who tried to break into it. In my view, this attempt has been quite successful. So this book, I mean, it won't teach you any particular data analysis techniques, but I think it will teach you how to be a strategist, how to be a data strategist, and how to apply those techniques to solve complex strategic problems.
Wonderful. Never heard of that book, and sounds very interesting. And also, being a chess player myself, or when I was younger, I was very into chess as well. So there you go, guys. How Life Imitates Chairs by Garry Kasparov. Thank you very much, Dmitry. Really appreciate you coming onto the show and sharing your insights. I'm sure lots of our listeners will find all this useful. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, man.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. I definitely learned a lot. Even though I knew Dmitry before, I still learned a lot about his career and about fraud analytics in general. And overall, it's good to know that this area of analytics exists, and a lot of people don't even think about a possibility of a career pathway there. And maybe if you enjoyed the things we talked about, the methodologies, the type of work that he was talking about, and the different investigations that Dmitry mentioned, maybe this is something that you might want to consider for your own career. And remember to get the show notes at www.superdatascience.com/5, so just the number 5, and there you can get the transcript and get all the recommended materials and all the items that we mentioned in the podcast. And if you enjoyed today's episode, then make sure to share it with your friends and colleagues and anybody who you know who might want to get into the space of data science. And I can't wait to see you next time. Until then, happy analyzing.